Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham, Dhammam, Sanghaṃ namassāmi. Now, 46 years later, from having first encountered the Buddha's teachings, the Dharma, I realize reverence is a very important quality. In constellating a condition where we're more likely to see things as they are, I had a hint of it 46 years ago when I made a decision to address quite a big decision, changing my life course. I didn't really recognize it at the time. I was a graduate student at Oxford University on a Rhodes Scholarship. Weary. I was 24, but felt like I was 104. I was tired of competing. I knew that I was confused, knew that I was suffering, knew that on paper I should be happy in terms of a certain measure of accomplishment. I met someone. I did my first meditation retreat. I think I mentioned it. I had a little glimpse of peace. And after the retreat, the managers of the retreat, it was at a little retreat center outside of Oxford called Oakenholt. And the managers of the retreat, I guess on the last day, or they said, "Oh, there's a visitor here who's from Thailand. He's looking for a place to stay in Oxford. He wants to talk to some Oxford philosophers, but he's interested in Buddhism." I said, "Oh, well, he can stay in my flat. That's all right." I was a flat, like an apartment on Beaumont Street. And this man, actually his pictures down in the hut, in the gratitude hut, a Dr. Douglas Burns was a psychiatrist. But he was studied Buddhism. He'd done all sorts of outdoorsmen. He had trekked across the North Pole. He had dined with the royal family of Thailand. He was very confident. And so he came and we were talking in my flat, and he talked about that he was doing a study. He's studying all these different meditation monasteries in Thailand and doing personality tests on all the different monks over years and just noticing what effect meditation has on the personality. So I'm thinking, yeah, okay. And very confident. Then he talked about, and there's a monk that's very special, and his whole being shifted. And he said, I believe he's enlightened, and he has a small band of Westerners with him, Ajahn Chah. And the senior Westerner, if he's not enlightened, he's close. But there was something about this strong, confident. He could do anything and everything. When he talked about Ajahn Chah, this softening. I wouldn't even have had the word reverence. But there was reverence. And something happened when I felt that. As I mentioned, I think the other day, I had no idea what enlightened or enlightenment meant, but I knew in my life, as a wrestler, incredible good fortune to have a coach, a good coach, or a really good wrestler to learn from. Teachers through university, high school, university, a really good teacher. Had the power to bless, to encourage, to reveal, to stimulate. So hearing about Ajahn Chah, I thought, I have to go. And he said, I'll take you. So I went. But why do I say all these years later, reverence is so important? Because our views, our opinions about what is, what's good, what's bad, what's mine, what's not mine, what's true, what's not, that's not reverence. That's being enchanted by our views and opinions. The true nature of reverence is not just, you know, blindly believing in something, but it's a quality of heart that is humble. That's open. That's appreciative of something wider. A conviction that an opinion, a judgment, notice what that does. It limits us. Very grateful that we have this opportunity together, and that, as it's been mentioned yesterday and today, we're right in the heart. Like right now is just a little bit beyond the halfway point of the retreat. And really grateful for all the effort that's been made. It's not easy. Being with ourselves in this way. It might seem like it, all those people out there sitting on their butt, world's going up in flame, and they're not out there doing something. To be with lessening distraction, to be with the way things are, as our dear friend and teacher, colleague who we spent years training with, Ajahn Sujito, he used to say about retreats, he says, Kitty, You're eyeball to eyeball with your karma. What we've set in motion, the habits, the tendencies, they come up. I mean, it sounds so easy, you know, relax, be in nature. Enjoy the bliss of just breathing in and breathing out. And when the heart gets the hang of it, that can really be blissful. But the unacknowledged, undigested restlessness, the unprocessed resentments and grief, the longings, the unacknowledged exhaustion, come to the surface. And with our wonderful teaching team, we've been encouraging everyone to welcome, make that effort. It's not easy to welcome, to be with the visitors that arrive, and to use this opportunity to allow our body, which is in present time, to be an anchor, a foundation of our cultivation of awareness, cultivation of mindfulness through walking, through sitting, mindfulness of breathing. And we've reflected some on the, just a template, but the nature of some of the so-called niwaranas, the hindrances that enchant us, that keep us from really intimately communing with how it is. The sense desire that's not really content with how it is wanting to get something, to grasp something. Aversion, knocking something away, heaviness, dullness, its mirror image, restlessness, worry, anxiety, entangles, thickets of worries and thoughts and indecisions and. But we've been encouraged that these two are dharmas. They're part of nature that can be welcomed, that can be investigated. And we've been contemplating the nature, the changing nature. And contemplating this ennobling truth of dukkha. One translation is of dukkha, as was beautifully laid out by our team. It's just to say suffering, misery is very limited, but one translation is not easy to bear. It's not easy to bear this experience of dukkha. And the Buddha laid out the range. Sometimes he describe the experience of suffering like in eight different ways. You know, birth is dukkha. The experience of birth for the mother or for the child, not easy to bear. I don't remember, but mom said she fell down some steps before I was born. So I came a month early. She says, "Kitty Sorrow, I think I know why you became a monk." I said, "Why is that, Mom?" She says, "That incubator was your first meditation cell." I think I spent a month in an incubator. I said, maybe so, Mom. She smiled, but birth is not easy. aging. I can verify. It's not easy. Aches, joints, creaking, senses, struggling. Just not easy to bear. Sickness, birth, old age, sickness, not easy to bear. We know this. Death, not easy to bear. Birth, old age, sickness, death, dying of the body, loss of loved ones, not easy to bear. Those are the first four. Then being united with the unloved, the Buddha said, when we get put together what we don't want to be with, it's not some difficult concept. That's not easy to bear. Where finding ourselves sitting next to who we didn't want to sit next to. Or when a sickness comes and we didn't want it to come just at that time, it's being together with something we didn't want to be with. When a harsh noise comes, something we don't want, it's not easy. The next one, being separated from the loved, separated from what is dear, what is precious, what we enjoy. That's not easy to bear. We all can reflect in our lives. Being with that which we don't want to be with, being separated from that which we might be a loved one, a circumstance that is, things are going just right. Not getting what you want. The seventh one, we want something. Doesn't happen. Not getting what you want, the Buddha said, is dukkha. Four days in, I should have had jhana. And then they went and said they weren't focusing on jhana. Even without focusing on jhana, jhana is when we get calm, different levels of calm. Ajahn Chah said we can get too involved with what are we going to call it, this jhana first sec. He said, know when you get a little more calm. Talking about calm, levels of composure and calm, unification. Wanting to get calm when I might have gotten, if it wasn't for that chainsaw, and wasn't for this mask, or wasn't for that memory, not getting what we want. But the last one's very interesting, sums them all up. He said, in short, the five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. Just making it this far in the retreat already there, we might not appreciate it, but there's a lot of blessings just in non-harming, making the effort to cultivate presence, mindfulness. Collectively, we've generated a lot of good karma and very little unwholesome karma. I mean, I don't think anybody's in between sessions has robbed a bank or done. That is wonderful, but also, and we can just ride on the blessings. There are significant blessings that we've cultivated, but I'm really encouraging us to. Take this composure that we've gathered and reinvest it, continue into looking into the nature of things. In short, dukkha is the five focuses of the grasping mind. What are we noticing? What are we being encouraged to notice? We've got a bit of calm, and then we've been encouraged by our team to, with this calm, to begin to notice the characteristic of change. That's taking some of the composure and just slightly shifting the focus to reflect on the nature of the moment. When the mind is inclined more toward just calm, then the heart's just steadying itself on the in vibratory sensation, the out vibratory sensation. The in brightening, flush of the in-breath, the out relaxing, calming, soothing. That's important. That's a skill that little by little we can, over the days, weeks, months, years that we have, that's an incredible skill for little by little learning how to tune the body-mind and enjoy a pleasing, relatively speaking, pleasing abiding that doesn't harm anyone, that's healing, that's wholesome, that doesn't just chew up resources. It's blessed, but it's impermanent. And if that's the only blessing that we know, it's wonderful when we have that calm, but when the calm is not there, when illness or external conditions make it such that it's hard to do that, then what is our refuge? Yes, that's skillful to cultivate that, but I would like us to also invest some of this composure. Ajahn Chah encouraged us always to, rather than just endlessly wanting more calm, more calm, more calm, to contemplate the nature of condition. And when we actually contemplate the nature, for example, of breathing, that's why the last tetrad, the liberating insight, looking into the nature of things, liberates us from wrong notions, from wrong views. We contemplate is breathing in and out the changing nature of a sensation. We notice the actual experience of receiving that life-giving in-breath. It's becoming otherwise every instant. The so-called in-breath ends. There's a pause, then it becomes an out-breath that's changing every instant. This day, at a dawn, expanding of the light element, countless experiences we've had during the day. the so-called day sounds like a noun, a thing, the day. The Tuesday night Dharma talk sounds like a thing. But if a quality of our composure notices the actuality of Dharma talk, the sounds and phrases of the Dharma talk. So the word Dharma talk is pointing, it's just a pointer to something that's actually anicjang, it's ephemeral. Full of holes and gaps. Can you really get to the essence? Not just Dharma talk, anything, any so-called thing, every thought. Every form we can focus on is changing. Every moment, every sound, every sight. And yet on multiple choice questions, we could, you know, just, do things change? Yes. Does your bank account ever change? Yes. Is there any change in the stars? Yes. But what's the implication? We really, really appreciate the... It changes everything. What we take to be... What do we take to be me and mine? I think Dawn brought up in her talks, you know, the worldly winds or the hurricanes. And the suffering that comes when we, or as Ajahn Chah says, you know, when we look for certainty in that which is uncertain, we're bound to suffer. All that effort I made to be successful, and it was not evil effort, it was good effort. But what is success? I was working hard to, when I was younger, say, be a wrestling champion. I worked for years. Won the Mid-South tournament a bunch of times, but then I wanted to win this national tournament in the Northeast, the National Invitational for Prep Schools in Pennsylvania. And training, I was doing 500 push-ups a day, climbing ropes. And when I was, came in, I think, second once and then third once, but then when I was 17, I won it. And I had my hand lifted up, and Mom took pictures, and I was a champion, national champion. But how long does your arm stay up? Randy, I've got the picture in the scrapbook. You do, Mom. Bless you. They were there. So encouraging. What encouraging parents I had. But within, I think within an hour, they were then taking pictures of all the champions of the different weight classes. And I was already worried about who might come back, because I was going to come back the next year. Who might I have to fight next year? This idea that we arrive at success and then we're just there. It's like a mirage. It keeps... We had a dear friend who was one of the most successful business people in South Africa. One of the executives, big gold mining corporation, but just to deal with the stress of all he had to do, predict the price of gold and all this stuff. Had to drink a bottle of wine a day just to calm down at night. Had nightmares. Once Tanisha asked him, well, when will it ever finish? And he said, when I'm successful. How could you get more successful? There's always something. And this is not saying not to work hard, but why is it called a worldly win when we're chasing something? The nature of success and failure is it's flickering. It's something that's changing every moment is dukkha. That's why it's called the focuses of the grasping mind. The grasping mind says success is dukkha because it shifts. Praise and blame is the same way. It's so nice to be appreciated. It is. It's nice to be appreciated. It blesses one. But it's also anicca. It's changing someone. That was a beautiful job you did. Oh, thank you. It's lovely to appreciate. But when the consciousness leans on that, that's called becoming. We become that. Well, I'm okay. I'm pretty good. I had to work hard to get here, mind you. A lot of work, but we made it. Hallelujah. And then someone frowns at you. You made what? You made me unhappy. I did. Praise and blame, or we get ignored, or... What is the nature of praise and blame? What is the nature of dawn, midday, dusk? What is the nature of in-breath and out-breath? When we get excited by success or praise or even pleasure, happiness, then when it inevitably shifts and changes, we become distressed. Excited with success, pleasure, distress. Imagine if we just get excited with the in-breath, distressed with the out-breath. Oh, here comes one. Oh, excited with the in-breath. Oh, God, there's that out-breath again. Oh, here it comes. Or the child that says, Mommy, Mommy, that... The full moon's so beautiful. I wish it was full all the time. But that's the wish of a child. It's innocence, beautiful. But the moon waxes and wanes. Pleasure and pain. Success and failure. The saints, the sages, the Buddha had failed Dhamma talks. People who didn't get it. He had people trying to kill him. The Buddha's body aged so that he had to put something under his back and lie down. The five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. When the grasping mind takes what these appearances... to be self, That's birth in the moment, yes, that moment of I'm made it. Then when it shifts and changes and we feel dislocated and there's looking for certainty somewhere else. And as Ajahn Chah said, when you look for certainty in that which is uncertain, you're bound to suffer. So seeing the nature of change is very powerful, very important. When there's, we chanted that big long conditionality from ignorance to suffering and then to the end of suffering. It's called this, that conditionality. When there's ignorance and grasping, imagine something to be permanent, trustworthy, that's not, the result is dukkha. We lean on something and it changes, then we fall. This condition, all these conditions that are changing, the Buddha said, if there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, if there wasn't an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, then there would be no escape from the born, the become, the made, or conditioned. This moment is born now. The day was born and then it's aging, dying. This retreat as a form took birth. Now we're in the middle age of this retreat. Our body was born aging. This Dharma talk was born. It's aging. No offense, Kitty, I think it died on you. Thank you for that. I needed that. That's called the conditioned conditionality. If there was only that, then there would be no escape. But the Buddha said there's something that's not born, not dying, not conditioned. And that the Buddha realized that when there's no grasping and no aversion, the unconditioned, the true nature reveals itself. And the Buddha gave his first talk on the Four Noble Truths to his fellow ascetics who had abandoned him when they thought the Buddha, the aspiring Buddha, had just become soft because he decided to eat something to restore his energy. But the Buddha gave a talk on the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, birth, old age, sickness, death, being united with what you don't want, separated from the love, not getting what you want, this focuses of the grasping mind. And that this cause of this, the suffering needs to be understood, opening to, not to be ashamed of suffering, but to allow ourselves to be open to it. And then we start to see the cause of suffering is this grasping. Taking something to be me and mine that really isn't. We take health, we take pleasure, we take something and as me and mine, and it's not. It's part of nature. It's impermanent. It's not self. There's an ending to suffering when there's that letting go. Tanishwar was talking about letting be, letting go. this path to the ending of suffering. At the end of that talk, the Buddha said, ah, Kundanya knows, Kundanya knows. He saw one of his fellow ascetics had understood, had entered the stream, his Dharma eye had opened. He realized that what arises ceases. And that doesn't sound like much, but what arises ceases. If one really sees that every sound, every sight, every sensation, all that we cling to is ever eluding us, then the enchantment, the idea that we're going to get something, starts to fade. There's a dispassion, a disenchantment. Later, Kundanyo shared what the image, there was an image, an analogy that helped him. He called it guest dust. It helped him have the breakthrough. He said, I should just read it like he. He said that he was enlightened to the meaning of guest dust. He said it's like a traveler stops as a guest at a roadside inn, perhaps for the night or for a meal. When he's finished lodging there, when the meal is finished, he packs his bag and sets out again. He does not remain there at leisure. The host, however, does not go far away. The host remains, so the guest comes and goes. What remains? He was seeing, he noticed what arises ceases. The in-breath comes and then it becomes the out-breath. They're guests coming and going. What remains? The second image that helped him, again, when the sky clears up, he said, the morning sun rises with all resplendence and its golden rays stream into a house through a crevice to reveal particles of dust in the air. The dust dances in the rays of light, but the empty space is motionless. Considering it this way, what is clear and still is called space. What moves is called dust. Dust then means that which moves. The dust is dancing. We've seen the dust dancing in the light. Wanting the dust not to dance is that's crazy. The space is undisturbed. The traveler comes and goes. The host remains. Fixated on the that which moves, on the dust dancing, wanting health always to be health, wanting the pleasant always to be pleasant. That's like wanting the dust not to dance. Ajahn Chah used to say that's like walking up to a duck and saying, why aren't you a chicken? He said it's like standing by a river and shouting at the river, why are you flowing that way? You should flow that way. This fighting nature, when there's this Tanisra saying the letting be, letting the dust dance, letting the ephemeral nature of sights and sounds be. One starts to notice that which remains. One touches into the deathless. The Buddha taught that actually this true nature, what he realized, this timeless true nature is not coming and going. It's always here and now, beckoning us. If we're captivated by the idea of getting somewhere else, though, that obscures the depth of this moment. We're caught in the mirage of going to success or something. That's why it's so important to keep remembering that the true nature is all this activity is not going somewhere else. Is to more and more fully arrive here and now. Seeing the nature of our thoughts is not easy, but that's what I'm encouraging us in these last few days. We've laid a foundation through this diligent, this practice that we've done. It's not been easy. But the Buddha taught that if we can see the changing nature of thought, that which determines what is me and mine, then we can touch into the ever-luminous heart. In a famous teaching called the Sharangama Sutra, Sharangama means the durable, the indestructible. The Buddha taught the reason those who cultivate cannot accomplish unsurpassed awakening is that they do not know the two fundamental roots and are mistaken and confused in their cultivation. They're like one who cooks sand in the hope of creating a savory delicacy. What an image. Cooking sand, wanting, no, I'm working, don't disturb me. They may pass through as many eons as there are motes of dust, but in the end they will not obtain what they want. What are the two? Ananda, the Buddha's talking to his beloved disciple. The first is the root of beginningless birth and death. So this whole samsara, this continual birth and death, happiness and suffering, the root of birth and death, it's the mind that seizes upon conditions and that you and all living beings now make use of, taking it to be the self nature, taking it to be me. It's this mind that takes health, a pleasant feeling, praise, my opinion that I'm right and you're wrong. I'm right and you're wrong. It's the mind that takes hold of conditions. That's the root of birth and death, says the Buddha. Why is that the root of birth and death? We just contemplate, no matter what it is, whatever thought, whatever circumstance we grip onto, it's changing. It melts. Whatever it is. But when we feel right, or take the opposite, when we feel miserable, it's all going wrong. It's all going wrong. When it's all going wrong, we can't see the sky, can't see nature. The mind is focused on this feeling tone, this thought formation. It's just useless. It's not working. It's useless. So that's the first root. The second is the primal, pure substance of the beginningless, awakened nature. It is the primal, bright essence of consciousness that brings forth all conditions. Because of conditions, you consider it to be lost. Living beings lose sight of this original brightness, this fundamental understanding. Therefore, though living beings use it to the end of their days, they are unaware of it. And without it intending to, they enter the various destinies. The cause of birth and death, the mind that grasps hold of conditions like a mood, a worried mood, like a success. But this essence of consciousness, this fundamental knowing nature, what he called the original brightness, he said, it brings forth all conditions, but because we're so busy identifying with this and that, we don't see it. We don't open to it. Because of conditions, you consider it to be lost. What does that mean? Because of conditions, because we feel distressed, because we feel confused thought. Buddha nature. I don't know what the Buddha's talking about Buddha nature. This is called miserable nature. Because of conditions, you consider it lost. Living beings lose sight of the original brightness. Therefore, though they use it to the end of their days, Buddha says we're using this. All of this activity is happening within our essential nature. Cooking sand, hoping to get a savory meal. The other image that's used for this is polishing a brick, hoping to get a mirror. Don't disturb me, I'm working. That's going to be a long job. Or Ajahn Chah, looking for certainty in that which is uncertain. We're wanting our thoughts. No, I'm figuring it out. We're thinking. I'm getting cut. Yes, that's it. I knew I should have written it down. I think I did write it down. Tanisra put it somewhere. I told you my scraps of paper are important. Looking for certainty in that which is uncertain. And so when we really start to see that everything's changing, that we sometimes start to feel, that's called a great return, start to feel dispassion. We realize Ajahn Chah describes it like this, and this is what we have the chance to do, is start to use. Don't underestimate the value of contemplating change. When the body and mind are seen thus with wisdom, we are aware of all the old habits and patterns, seeing the impermanence of mind and body, the impermanence of the totality of all feelings of happiness and suffering, of love and hate, we realize there's only so much to them. They're merely what they are. The mind turns. It turns away and becomes weary of it all. Weary that these things appear and pass away. They're unreliable. Wherever we may be, we see this. When the mind becomes weary, its only concern will be to find a way out. We no longer want to live like we did before. We see the imperfections and liabilities of this worldly way of grasping, wanting something that's impermanent to make us happy. It's asking from nature what nature cannot give us. With this perspective, wherever we go, we will see the fact of the impermanent, unsatisfactory, selfless nature phenomenon. And there will be nothing we wish to get or grasp hold of. Sitting beneath a tree, we hear the teaching of the Buddha. Sitting atop a mountain, we hear the teaching of the Buddha. Sitting on a plane, we hear the teaching of the Buddha. We see the world much more clearly. The realms of form and formlessness we see more clearly. They become clearer in the light of impermanence. In the light of the unsatisfactory nature of things. In the light of this absence of a self. But as we let go, then something else opens up. The realm of the true, the heart itself, this what the Buddha called the original brightness. This essential nature, what the Buddha called the wondrous, enlightened, luminous understanding. It illuminates the entire Dharma realm within it. This is at the heart of all things, the heart of our being. Why reverence is so important when we're open to the mystery. When we don't have reverence, then I've seen 1,000 trees, Kitty Sorrow, it's a tree. Same old face in the mirror. With language, we think we know everything. Oh, that's him, that's her. He's not meditating. Look at him fidgeting over there. Yeah, I think I'm doing pretty good. Reverence is just our thoughts, just questioning and noticing these thoughts are visitors. They're bubbles that appear. When we get lost in a mood, like despair, it's all worthless. Oh, what's the point? When we take that to be me and that truth, we're in reverence to this manifestation of Dharma. We see that bubble burst into the listening. The Buddha said, it's like ignoring hundreds of thousands of pure seas and taking notice of only a single bubble. Seeing it as the entire ocean. Taking a bubble to be the whole sea. When we get lost in a thought, we forget that that thought is a bubble that appears and bursts into this ocean of listening. every thought, every sound arises and ceases in this boundless dimension of our nature. It's always shining. When we allow the ephemeral changing nature of a sight, a sound, a touch, and especially our thoughts, then each one can take us home when we allow the sounding and then the dissolving. As Tanisra said, let it be, let it come, let it go. And then as it dissolves, it helps revealing this sky-like stillness, the lightning flashes of conditions, the fireworks of conditions. We can appreciate them, but they wouldn't be if it wasn't for that immovable sky of awareness, of inner listening. So I encourage us to take advantage of these opportunities we have tonight and next few days to use our gathered presence, our samadhi, and there's considerable here that we've cultivated, to notice reverentially, with humility, the ephemeral nature of thoughts, and to practice letting things come and go, getting a feeling for that which is always here and now, always inviting us. I'll finish with a few words from our dear teacher Ajahn Chah. It can encourage us to do everything with a mind that lets go. Do not expect praise or reward. If you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will know complete peace. Your struggles with the world will have come to an end. Celebrating the goodness of this day. I'm so fortunate to be encouraged by our team, by all of you, to spend the day well. And just as the sun, 93 million miles away, a tiny sliver of its light powers this planet. Just being itself, it's sharing its radiance. We too have awesome radiance. So too at the end of this day. May the goodness from our moments of mindfulness, patience, harmlessness, cultivation be shared above, below, and all around without strain, with that letting be, letting go. May all beings wake up out of the enchantment. May we reverentially open to this mystery of this realm. For the welfare of all, Om Mani Padme Hum. For those who have the energy, can keep practicing. For those who need to.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.